Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we shall hear the third and last of the lectures being given under the general title The Assault on the French Enlightenment by this season's John Dance lecturer, Sir Isaiah Berlin. Last night, Professor Pease explained in some detail the John Dance bequest, its background and purposes, to which we are all indebted for these lectures among the others that many of you have attended. On Monday night, Dr. Katz recounted for us some major aspects of Sir Isaiah's academic background. And therefore, trading on the privilege of having known the speaker a bit for something like 25 years, I should like to add a word or two, if I might, about some of his other qualities. For one thing, he has served his country with distinction. During World War II, he was with the British Ministry of Information in New York, and later the British Embassy in Washington. It is said that during these years, he was the sort of person who could, on request of superiors, to look into, let us say, conditions in Jamaica, proceed in a manner somewhat as follows. He would gather up all available reports, voluminous in character, about Jamaica. He would read them through in record time, lay them aside, contemplate the ceiling, smoke his pipe furiously, and then go to his superior and would say, "This is how things are in Jamaica. These are the problems. These are the trouble spots. These are the issues that require attention." And as subsequent events would prove, he would invariably be right. According to oral tradition, these traits earned him such a reputation that Mr. Winston Churchill expressed a wish to meet him and asked that he be invited to dine. At a time before our speaker was knighted, a certain Mr. I. Berlin appeared for dinner with Mr. Churchill. During dinner, chatted amiably. After dinner, returned to the drawing room, where Mr. Berlin sat down at the piano and asked Mr. Churchill, "What would you like me to play?" In defense of Churchill's staff, it must be said that the entry for Mr. Irving Berlin immediately precedes the entry for Mr. Isaiah Berlin in Who's Who. And it could happen to anyone, especially anyone whose head is not quite screwed all the way on, and often does. Sir Isaiah also possesses considerable administrative talents. He has been one of the directors of Covent Garden's Royal Opera House, a governor of the University of Jerusalem. He is presently president of Wolfson College in Oxford, which is far from being only an ornamental title. Like the very few other truly great men I've been privileged to know, he takes an active and at the same time discriminating interest in his students. Indeed, one may hazard a guess that it is his extraordinary sensitivity to what all sorts of other people are like that accounts for part of his unparalleled success in studying the history of philosophy and intellectual history, which must in part comprise the history of philosophers and of intellectuals, as well as the history of philosophical and other ideas. He is the best living demonstration I know of the fact that the life of the mind can be fun, provided, of course, that one is able to bring to it a rigorous and many-sided education, a high degree of perception, a quick and precise kind of intellect, a wide-ranging experience of the world, and it might not be amiss to add, a not inconsiderable amount of energy. He has so much of all of these qualities that one is sometimes tempted to urge him to divide them up a little to share the wealth with the rest of us. To you as the momentary beneficiary of them, I am honored to introduce Sir Isaiah Berlin, speaking on the subject, Fichte and Romantic Self-Assertion.
Ladies and gentlemen, and Professor, and in particular Professor Treadgold, I should like to say that, of course, I'm most grateful for this very, very kind introduction. There are only two things I wish to say about that. The first is that it does a great deal, it's evidence in quite an obvious sense, far more of Professor Treadgold's sweetness of character, generosity and imagination than it is of any alleged qualities of mine. That's the first thing I'd like to say. The second thing I'd like to say, and these qualities I've always known in him. In fact, if he's not careful, I might launch an equally warm-hearted encomium of him. I think time alone will prevent me from doing that, and your patience. The other thing is, as for the famous story about the world-famous composer and myself, there are a great many versions of it, all true. Yes. As Herder said, myth and legend are just as enriching to life as excessive scruple and over-pedantic attitude towards actual facts. With this beginning, if I may, I shall begin. I must now talk about a very different figure, namely Fichte, a man who neither like Herder was a man of very generous character, nor like Kant, a man totally dedicated to the truth. Nevertheless, his influence in some respects was perhaps wider than that of either. Perhaps I ought to have said last time that Schiller's classification of mankind, at least of the history of mankind, into three stages, is what affected the imagination of his contemporaries. He discriminated three stages. First, what he called the savage stage, when men are simply victims of impulses, and a kind of Hobbesian universe prevails in which men, acted upon by their passions, fight each other and, in general, try and live with each other in a condition of considerable savagery and chaos, until finally order is restored by the stronger and more unscrupulous among them. The second stage is the development of rational ideas in which certain persons are set up in authority over others, and certain intellectual ideals develop. He called this particular stage in which men begin believing in principles and begin believing and behaving in accordance with strict principles, indeed to an almost idolatrous extent. He calls this stage not the stage of savagery, but the stage of barbarism, because any total subjection to principles without any criticism, any total submission to principles for their own sakes, and I'm afraid this is a kind of sideswipe at his great teacher Kant, he regarded as a form of idolatry, and this is the kind of thing which only barbarians do. The third stage is the stage of free men. Free men are men who, in some way, live open lives and follow some kind of ideal which is subject to constant criticism, constant revision, constant change. And, of course, when asked how this was compatible with any kind of civil administration, if every man followed his own free ideal, might there not be certain collisions? He escaped this criticism by saying, of course, he wasn't talking about the empirical world. In the empirical world, men were parts of this hideous causal treadmill, which they couldn't avoid. After all, they had bodies. These bodies obeyed certain physiological and physical laws, and these couldn't be altered by any amount of pursuit of liberty. But they must rise above this. And in their minds, they must live pure, dedicated, and free lives. And in particular, he illustrated this by saying that the salvation of men from the oppression and enslavement by material factors was to be attained through what he called play. And play he identified with art. Here, I don't wish to enlarge too much upon this conception, it would take up too much time, but the brief summary of it is that in art alone are you completely free, because there you impose laws upon yourself. We go back to Rousseau again. If you are he doesn't give these examples, but if you are, for example, a boy playing being a Red Indian, you are a Red Indian for these purposes. And the rules which you obey are rules which you've invented for the purpose of the game. Everything which you do obeys your own creative fantasy and imagination, and not some rigorous yoke derived from the external world which bends you to its inexorable necessity. Art for him is a form of free self-expression, but certainly it doesn't have very much to do with actual political or social life. What he really thought of was that in the rather gloomy world of the minor German principalities, in the even to him, in some ways gloomier world of the Jacobin terror in France, the only way for a free man to escape is to dedicate himself to purely spiritual activity and try and ignore as far as possible the grim necessities of actual life. Well, this particular form of escapism didn't really commend itself to people who actually were faced with acute and concrete problems of life, but it certainly had a profound effect upon the artistic and aesthetic thought, both in Germany and in other countries. Let me say one more thing before I come to Fichte himself, and that is this. If you ask at what stage exactly do you get this notion of the tragic hero, that's to say, you get the notion of a man oppressed by the necessities of empirical existence who escapes them in some way by rising above them, ignoring them, or at any rate fighting against them, whichever way out he takes, whether he takes out the what is called the barbarian way, which is to try and struggle against them unsuccessfully and go under in some fearful heroic duel, which is what presumably Karl Moor does in the play and others, or whether it is a question of rising above into some artistic empyrean and try to detach yourself from the world and live in a pure world of art and imagination and thought, like the Olympian gods, as Schiller says. If you ask at what particular point, it has to be placed, it seems to me, between 1768 and 1783. I will tell you why. In 1768, a play was written by Lessing, which was called Miller von Barnhelm, which those who read study German literature will know well. In this play, which I won't describe to you, it's not a particularly good play, the hero is a Prussian officer who has been unjustly disgraced for he's been accused of committing some disgraceful act of which he's perfectly innocent. He's a man of honor. He doesn't know how to clear himself. He's in love with a noble lady called Minna von Barnhelm. He can't meet her because he thinks that she must think that he has committed this awful crime. And therefore he sits in an inn, refuses to see her, refuses to see anybody, gradually gets into debt, refuses the help of his servant, and in general behaves in a proud, unapproachable, somewhat neurotic fashion. Minna von Barnhelm turns out to be an extremely sensible young woman who understands, grasps the situation, takes various steps in order to, so to speak, clear his name, and finally manages to produce a situation in which his name is cleared, he rejoins her, and they live happily forever after. Now, the point about Telheim, the officer, is that he's not really a hero, he plays a comedy. This pride, this honor, this inability to face people, this absolutely sort of impossible character which prevents people who try to help him from succeeding in helping him, is regarded as a blessing with a certain amount of irony. And the sensible Minna and her sensible friends who ultimately return him to good sense and to reason, good, sensible on people who understand the true world and how it goes, and manage to wean this rather proud, impossible man back into the paths of normal existence, they are the true heroes of the play. The same thing you will find, for example, in Molière's play Le Misanthrope, where the misanthrope also rejects the world because it's a corrupt and monstrous place, he wishes to have nothing to do with it, he complains about it all the time, and gradually is weaned back to some kind of sanity by a much more amiable, better balanced, more sensible, and altogether more intelligent friend, who gradually explains to him the way of the world and the fact that one mustn't resist it in this rather foolish and rather impossible fashion. Now, these misanthropic characters, who are wounded by the world and will not have it, and try and leave it in some sort of way, or at any rate battle against it. They become heroic in the forms of Carol Moore or Fiasco in Schiller in the 80s. That is the moment at which this particular change occurs, at which the notion of harmony, good sense, science, reason is to some extent abandoned, and a crown is placed upon the heads of passionate, dedicated, heroic characters who will not accept the world at its own valuation, who reject everything which is cheap and vile in it, who will not have anything to do with the dross with which it contains, and assert themselves, however tragically, however unsuccessfully, ultimately, however, so to speak, in a way pessimistically, and usually ending in some kind of fearful disaster against what might be called common sense, convention, and so forth, between then 1768 and 1783. This kind of mentality began to prevail among German young men, certainly, in the 1790s. This is what grew to maturity in those particular years. And Fichte was extremely characteristic of his time and his place. Like the other persons I've discussed, like Herder, like Kant, he was a man of humble birth. But unlike them, he was a man of peculiarly resentful nature, to whom it was, in fact, rather like the hero of one of these tragedies, it was almost impossible to help him. Anyone who tried to do anything for him was invariably cursed and slandered afterwards. In part, I think, his whole resistance to what might be called the French Enlightenment was certainly stimulated, partly by the kind of conception which he had of France and of Paris, by a comparison of his own humble birth and the inferiority complex which it led, and his provincial origins, his poverty, and so forth, as against these rich, complacent, bewigged figures, so to speak, who could talk about human happiness and human wisdom from the comfort of their wealth and their power. So that to some degree, there was a certain element, if you like, of personal resentment or personal feeling, which I dare say was shared by a good many provincial Germans when they contemplated this rich, but to them unapproachable world of grandeur and fashion in Paris of that particular time. Fichte became a pupil of Kant's, that's to say he went to his lectures in Königsberg, and improved upon it, improved in his own mind. Certainly Kant didn't think it an improvement, as you will presently hear. He accepted what really fascinated him, and fascinated his contemporaries in some way, was of course Kant's central notion, namely, that the world, as understood by men, was as it was because of the forms imposed upon it by the human mind. That these forms were not so much discovered as imposed upon it, that man found in the world that which he had himself imposed upon it, not consciously, not deliberately, but in some unconscious state, in some pre-imaginative state, which Kant doesn't really describe very clearly, where man categorizes the world, arranges certain categories in it, which afterwards are rigid and unaltering, simply because his mind has already imposed upon them, and the world is already cut into segments, so to speak, by it, as it were, before man ever comes to consciousness of it. Fichte, however, went rather further in this direction. Kant's self, in this sense, performs its work in darkness. We have to deduce that this must have happened. Nobody is aware of this particular. It isn't that you stand over the world and do something consciously to it. The spectacles through which you see the world are born with you. They are not placed upon your nose by yourself at some conscious moment of your existence. Fichte pushed this forward by two powerful arguments, which in their way deserve respect. The first is this, he says, philosophers, and his views really emerge from his theory of knowledge. He says, philosophers assert various things, and men in general assert various things to be true. When you ask why a particular statement is true, whatever it might be, whether it's scientific or commonsensical, the normal thing is to ask for the ground of such a statement, and you try and give what ground you can in order to show that what you are saying is valid or true. But this ground is subject to further criticism of the same sort, and you say, what is the ground for the ground? And what is the ground of the ground of the ground? And this can go on indefinitely. Now, how is this to be solved? Why is there not a vicious regress here? Why shouldn't people constantly ask for the because of the because of the because? So to speak, or the why of the why of the why. And he says, what actually happens is, of course, not this at all. This is a false view of human knowledge. This is a view which really is inherited from Locke. by which we are a kind of tabula rasa upon which the external world makes certain impressions which we afterwards discover in ourselves. But this isn't what happens. We are born with certain questing desires. We are born with certain purposes. This is what men as men are. That is how they differ, he thinks, both from plants and from beasts, who really are objects upon which nature makes certain impressions, who simply behave or respond in some mechanical fashion. Men seek for something. This even the human child seeks for something. And the world presents itself to this child in some way in terms of the question which it asks of it. A table is not an object, which I simply describe as a four-legged thing or a three-legged thing standing in front of me. A table is something which I use for the purpose of putting books on it or putting food on it. That's what a table is. It is I who make the table a table. Grass is green because I am at that moment engaged in discriminating colors. In other words, he is the author, or one of the earliest authors, of the whole theory of intentionality, as it is now called, by which fundamentally the world is an answer to certain unspoken questions on the part of its investigators. This is the kind of thing which now in aesthetics, for example, Professor Gombrich has made popular, and various philosophers of science have discussed. That is to say, the fact that men don't simply describe what they see before them in some impartial, objective fashion, but always have a certain framework, already have a certain attitude towards it, if you like, a certain theory about it. This is too grand a word, perhaps, for the undeveloped human being. But at any rate, certain hypotheses about it, they need something, they ask something of it. Every object which a man describes is something which, to use pragmatic language, he wants to use for something, or is afraid of, or is attracted to, or it's either an obstacle in his life, or on the contrary, it's something which he wants to use. A tree is something which may yield fruit. A tree is something which he may knock against. In other words, every object has to be defined in terms of the actual purposive behavior of human beings, which in a sense can be translated as answers to unformulated questions. If this is so, says Fichte, and he believes this, and it is an idea of some insight of some brilliance, if this is so, then what really happens is that we cut this chain of the why of the why of the why, ground of the ground of the ground, by an act of will. The world is that which we will it to be. My world is that which, whether I know it or not, corresponds to what I want it to be, or rather, it may not correspond to it, but at any rate, it answers badly or well to something which I want of it, or ask of it, or demand of it. And this demand, this asking, this thrusting forward activity is what he calls the will. This he derives from Kant, only he rather alters it, if you like, he perverts it. He makes of it a very deliberate affair, so to speak, even in matters of knowledge, where Kant didn't use this concept of will at all. This distressed Kant very much, particularly when Fichte's first publication on the subject was, since it was published anonymously, was assumed by people to be a new brilliant work by Kant. Kant was extremely distressed and did everything possible to disown this appalling thing which appeared to him to remove the basis from his own work and to be a piece of absurd and imaginative, fantastic exaggeration and distortion of his own much more orthodox views. At any rate, that was Fichte's beginning. The second aspect of this, and it really is a kind of aspect of it, is the notion not only that it is an act of will, the world is what we will it to be, so to speak. And it says quite explicitly, the world, so to speak, is the world of one kind of creature, is a world different from the world of another kind of creature. It's rather like Wittgenstein's famous remark about the world of the happy is different from the world of the unhappy. Fichte says, in effect, the world of poets is different, let us say, from the world of bankers. There are certain things, obviously, which are common to them, but what they need, what they want of their world is so different that things must appear to them in different relationships. Colors, tastes, objects appear in different relationships in accordance with the temperamental demands which half-consciously men make upon it when they first enter upon it, even in their childhood. The second aspect of this very thing is Fichte's concept of the Anstoß, or impact. He says, supposing if you read Kant, you might think that man begins anyhow by being a purely cognitive animal. All you do is contemplate. You contemplate the world and then you do your best. You describe it, you find various things in it, you ask about various relationships in it. Descartes asserts them. Hume denies them, Kant tries to patch the thing up, and so on. He says, if we were pure contemplators, particularly if we were successful contemplators, we wouldn't be aware of ourselves at all. Anybody who is totally absorbed and successfully absorbed in contemplation of anything, in listening to music or watching a sea or anything of the sort, if you are completely absorbed in it, you don't feel yourself at all. All that exists before you is a datum in which you are completely sunk and absorbed. What makes you feel yourself as yourself, what first gives you your notion of a self at all, is of course resistance on the part of this external object, frustration, not substance, but obstinance, so to speak, although he didn't use this particular term. Some kind of resistance, it's when you want something and can't get it. It's when you want this particular pear, but it's too high above your grasp. It's if some animal comes and does you harm, so to speak, that you become aware of the difference in yourself and it, yourself and the tree, your desire and its frustration. And therefore, it's in a sense the collision of this of a subject with something outside, which makes the subject first aware of itself as something seeking, something questing, something which is to be distinguished from the not-self, the not-self being simply the theatre of its volitional activities, of its thrustings forward and the fearful frustrations and bruises which it occasionally gets in the course of this. This, therefore, is Fichte's notion of the self. The self becomes aware of itself in action, and in the beginning is action and not contemplation. This is the absolute foundation of Fichte's thought, and a great deal emerged from that. In the beginning was the act. In Beginn war die Tat, as Goethe afterwards put in his Faust, which is a direct Fichtean sentiment. In the beginning was not knowledge, not logos, not understanding, but a thrusting forward, a demand, an attempt to squeeze the universe, to adapt it to your needs, whatever they might be. Now, given that, and of course, as I say, Kant was aghast by this. It wasn't at all his kind of notion. Now, the way in which Fichte puts this is by saying consciousness of the real world is derived from action, not the other way about. We do not act because we know. We know because we are called upon to act. This is an effect that I've been trying to say. We know because we are called upon to act, we can't help acting, and we derive knowledge from whether our act succeeds or not. Supposing you find a solipsist, he says, who pretends that he's not sure whether you exist or not. Someone who's not quite sure whether the world exists or not. One of these pseudo-doubters, as he thinks them. People who express doubts which no sane person could really feel. But of course, some people do sometimes get into that state of mind. They're not quite sure whether the real world exists. Perhaps it's all an illusion. He says, if you meet a man like that, you must... it's quite simple what you must do. You must treat him as if he was a piece of rude matter, he says. Strike him. Insult him. Do something awful to him. You will find that he'll be very indignant with you. He will not be indignant with his own creation. He will not be indignant with his own illusions. He'll be indignant with you. He'll become perfectly aware of the difference between you and him. He will no longer doubt that you are not he, and that the world contains, at any rate, two agents and not one. This is the way. This is the way to reason with doubters who aren't really doubting, but merely pretend to do so. Do something, so to speak, which he will not be able to avoid. If you succeed in irritating him and annoying him, you will find that you've taught him something. This is very much how the world appears to a child, so to speak, the frustrating world, the world which doesn't answer expectations. If you find a grown-up child pretending to be a solipsist, behave as cruel nature behaves to children. The great move which Fichte made, and this is really absolutely the heart of Romanticism, which I should like to emphasize with all the stress that I have in my possession. The real point is that Fichte said, we are creators. We are essentially creators in the Schiller sense of the word. I do not exist for nature. She exists for me. This is a flat denial of the Enlightenment, of Locke, of Helvetius, of Holbach, of all these persons in the 18th century. There isn't something called nature which I carefully study, which I carefully describe, which I must find out the workings of, which I must find out the structure of. Nature exists for me because I am constituted as I am, whatever I may turn out to be, that he won't tell you at the moment. However I may be, nature exists for me and not I for her. Nature is what I take her to be. It's, so to speak, the field of focus of my volitional activities. And he goes on to say, I am not determined by an end, say a value, passion for the truth or whatever it is, or passion for life, or passion for beauty, or passion for happiness, or whatever ends people have set before themselves. I am not determined by the end is determined by me. Now, Kant never said that. He never actually said that I, so to speak, create ends out of nothing. There is a rational activity which tells me what the categorical imperative is and tells not only me, but every other rational being who chooses to use rational methods for asking himself, what is my duty and what are my proper rational ends. Fichte has overstepped this particular limit. He has, so to speak, cut man loose from the only cord which held him to the old rational world, which Kant certainly preserved most carefully. I determine my own ends. My ends don't determine me. I invent them in some sense. I create them. Now let me tell you, this is quite a moment in the history of thought. It is a moment because until then, broadly speaking, the idea was that ends or goals, say of art, or of life, or of morality, were in some sense discoverable. How you discovered them, as I tried to tell you in my first lecture, you could argue about for a long time, whether you discover them empirically or metaphysically or theologically, by intuition, by revelation, by whatever it means, but it's there, and what you think about it makes no difference to it. The important thing is to get it right. And that is why you admire the sages, who in your opinion have got it right, and therefore lived their lives successfully in the light of their discovery. Fichte is the first thinker who explicitly says, ends are not discoverable, they're invented. They're not created, they're not found, they're made. Now if ends are made, a great deal follows. If ends are made, they're no longer propositions, they're no longer answers to questions in the sense in which the discoveries of physics or the discoveries of chemistry, in which Fichte took no interest whatever, could be regarded as that. If ends are actually created or invented or made, then the question of whether, for example, all true answers are compatible with each other doesn't arise, because these things aren't answers, they're forms of action. I determine myself in a certain direction, I simply set before myself the end, I will paint this picture, I will create this piece of music. You can't say, is this piece of music compatible with that particular painting? Is this piece of music, it doesn't make sense, pieces of music aren't propositions, they aren't true or false, they are creations. If I create things, the whole problem of truth and falsehood drops away. The model is in fact aesthetic. Let me tell you, this is the crucial center, I think, of the whole, if you like, irrationalist or romantic or self-expressive movement. Broadly speaking, and I don't wish to enlarge on this either, the history of certainly political and social thought, and I dare say of all thought of a large kind, of a general kind in general, is a succession of illuminating models. For Plato, perhaps, the chief model was geometry or something of that kind, at any rate mathematical. And he thought that if you could understand the world, if you attained to the idea of the good and saw from that great height what the necessary connections are which hold the world together as a harmonious whole, you would then understand yourself in it. For Aristotle, the model was more biological than it was mathematical. Many models followed. The social contract was a legal model, which in some way illuminated for the people of the time who conceived it some kind of relationships in society which were not illuminated by conceiving of society as in some way a geometrical construction. There were organic models. People thought, for example, that the world was in some way an organic whole, and there were mechanical models. People thought of it as I say, Diderot once said, as a kind of factory, or at any rate as a machine. Well, each of these models always illuminated people, told them something which, so to speak, they perhaps hadn't thought of before, put the world in a different light, illuminated certain things so that they felt that now that they used this model, they understood something which previously had in some way been obscure. But of course, in liberating them in that way, it also obscured what the earlier model had created. And in the end, this model, as always happens with models, proves constricting, proves inadequate, proves a kind of straitjacket, and a new model arises. The 18th century model was certainly a mechanistic model of sorts, sometimes biological, sometimes mechanistic, but that was the analogy in terms of which people tried to explain to themselves the structure of society, the structure of human relationships, the relation of body to mind, and the rest of it. The model which is now used by Fichte is an aesthetic model. That is to say, model which is taken from creation. The world is what we invent. Life is something which we, if we're conscious and if we are, so to speak, fully developed, we create it out of nothing, in a sense. We invent ourselves. We proceed forward and we make our lives as we choose in some sort of way, within the limits of empirical possibility. And he doesn't mind about empirical possibility. He thinks empirical possibility confines us, but he's proposed to ignore that. Within these limits, it's possible to construct spiritual entities, which is all that means anything to him. Art, religion, philosophy, moral attitudes, social attitudes, political attitudes. The Russian revolutionary Herzen, writing in the 19th century, put this, I think, with extreme vividness when he said, "Where is the song before it's sung? Where is the dance before it's danced?" And the answer to this was, nowhere, obviously. But this was not so for the 18th century. As I tried to tell you in my first lecture, for Sir Joshua Reynolds, there was a Platonic model there, which the painter was trying to penetrate through the veil and mist of empirical experience, through trying to penetrate through the curtain of mere empirical experience. For earlier thinkers, there really were ideals of beauty, ideals of moral rightness or goodness, ideals of various types, ideals of how life should be lived, which clever, gifted, or perhaps God-instructed, intuitive persons could discover. And the discovery was real discovery. You discovered the truth. Not so if you produce the new analogy with a new kind of art, with a new Herderian art. The new Herderian art, which is simply creation, invention. Where is the folk song before the anonymous creators of the folk song invented it? It isn't anywhere. It doesn't lie there in the heavens waiting to be fetched down, waiting to be discovered, waiting simply to be written down, so to speak, on music paper. It's invented out of nothing, and the creation out of nothing becomes the great obsessive concept of the time of which I wish to speak. Now, the application of the model of the artist creating the work of art, which is made in accordance with his own unfettered will, the application of this to social life and to political life is really the big revolutionary and in some way highly destructive step, which was taken in the first place by Fichte, basing himself on Kant but exaggerating it and distorting it to a very high degree. One can quite see that Kant, who believed in the truth, who believed in reason, who believed in all these things, in spite of his passionate defense of the freedom of the self, would have been outraged and horrified by this. "I do not accept what nature offers," said Fichte, "because I must, like Locke." You see, the idea of being nature impresses something on me. "I do not accept what nature offers because I must. I believe it because I will." And he goes on to say, "Man shall be and do something." That is, man's fate is to realize himself in some way, to objectify himself in some way. Well, the young Fichte still talks fairly, politically at least, harmless language. To subject all irrational nature to himself, to rule over nature without restraint and according to a man's own laws, that is the proper task of man. Very well, that simply is the old Kantian principle by which we must organize nature and not submit to her. Civilization means using all our powers for the purpose of complete freedom, complete independence of everything which is not ourselves, our pure ego, whatever that might be. So act that you can look on the dictate of your will as a law for you. To be a subject to law means to be a subject to our own insight. I'm still quoting Fichte. It means the right of a man to follow only his own insight, and this is violated by coercion. "Man shall determine himself and never allow anything foreign to determine him. If he should be what he is because he wills it, then alone will he be free. I have chosen the system I have adopted, not because I must, I believe it, because I will." Again, I'm not determined by the end, I determine it. "A law is not drawn from the realm of fact. It is drawn from our own self." That is the big step forward. "I don't discover, I make." He becomes more and more extravagant at this point. He now says, The world is a poem dreamt out in my inner life. Well, this is a very extravagant way of putting, perhaps it doesn't literally mean it, a very extravagant way of putting to say the world is what I make of it, the world is as it appears to me, the world is what I choose to make it, particularly my moral world, my artistic world, my spiritual world. So that our worlds, as I say, are literally different if we differ morally. And that is why he says, different philosophers believe different things because they have different characters. First study the character of the philosopher and you will know how the world appears to him and what he believes. There isn't a common criterion to people differently formed, with different ambitions and different characters. And he finally, suddenly says, I am wholly my own creation. This is the kind of thing which Bertrand Russell afterwards, not without reason, mocked at somewhat. He didn't think on the whole that he was wholly his own creation, and with some reason. But this is merely Fichte's highly exaggerated way of saying that the world in which I live is shaped by my own deliberate and creative efforts. However, when it was pointed out to him that after all the empirical world wasn't created by him, he didn't invent gravitation, he didn't invent matter, he didn't invent the laws of chemistry and physics, he said, very well, I'm a member of two worlds. There is, of course, the empirical world which I don't wish to speak about, and there is a spiritual world where I really am free. And this is the only world that is worth discussing. Now, when applied to politics, he says, if a man allows laws to be made for him by the will of others, he thereby makes himself into a beast. That is, he injures his inborn human dignity. Man can neither be inherited, nor sold, nor given away. He cannot be the property of anyone, because he is and must remain his own property. And he goes on from there to say, man may not make any other man either virtuous or wise or happy against his will. This, as you can see, is a doctrine of extreme individualism. The end of man is self-development. As Herder spoke of groups, or nations, or communities, or societies, so Fichte now, deriving directly from Herder, and to some extent from Schiller's Heroes, says a man must realize himself. And that, and if anyone leads him by the nose, if anyone directs him, if anyone manipulates him, then he is a slave. This is extreme individualism, and that is why Fichte in his youth welcomed, as they all did, the French Revolution, because this appeared to him somehow to break the chains of the awful French oligarchies, of the church and the aristocracy, and allow each free French human being to vote and act in his own free way. When the Terror arose, Fichte duly recoiled, but that is still some time to come. At this stage, you can see that this course of thought is going to lead him to some kind of idealistic anarchism. The ultimate aim of all government is to make all government superfluous. Because government, of course, in some way directs you. But you are not free unless you direct yourself. The state, like all human institutions, aims at its own destruction. All human institutions are only temporary makeshift affairs enabling immature people who haven't yet understood what their particular aims are, so to speak, to not to injure each other. That is all institutions are. They're merely temporary devices, mere dodges, so to speak. They have no Burkean sacredness in themselves. They aren't institutions which naturally flow from human nature, as say Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas thought. They're mere weapons, tools, dodges, utilitarian devices in order to keep people in some kind of leading strings before they're completely mature. Once man is mature, institutions will drop off him. The state, like all human institutions, aims at its own destruction. It is the aim of every government to make itself superfluous. This is a straight doctrine, so to speak, of self-directed, self-expressive anarchism in which every man is his own master, every man realizes himself as best he can. Naturally, the question must have arisen, what happens if I realize myself in manner X, and you realize yourself in manner Y, and we come into hideous collision with each other? If you have a community of people realizing themselves in all kinds of haphazard fashions, and banging into each other, which is bound to happen, surely this can't be quite right. And Fichte said, well, yes, in these circumstances, of course, something has to be done, because that shows that people aren't completely mature. If men really understood themselves as they should understand themselves, they would realize that harmony and peace are the natural condition of the race. Egoism would wither away. Egoism is only a relic of some kind of ancient enslavement. People would become altruistic, love would develop among them, and they would live happily forever after. This is, roughly speaking, the doctrine of what might be called a somewhat simplistic Rousseauian anarchism, which says institutions corrupt men. Remove institutions and men will rise to their full size, and by nature, no man ever wants to do damage to any other man, and if he knows enough about what he is and where he is, he will in fact not do it. Well, the only thing which causes men to be as destructive and as unhappy as they are these dreadful institutions which enslave them against their own wills. This is how Fichte begins, at any rate, in the late 80s and early 90s. What is the function of man? The function of man is to realize his natural vocation. I have one vocation, you have another. I am a poet, you are a cook. You must realize your vocation as a cook, I must realize my vocation as a poet. This is called das Aufgegebene, as opposed to das Gegebene. Gegebene is what is given, this I reject. This enslaves me. Aufgegebene is my vocation, that which I, with full force of my imagination and will, I conceive as being my end. And why is it something which I ought to realize? Because it's my end. Not because it's good, which would make it good for everybody. Not because it's right, which for Kant at least would make it right for everybody. Not because I can interpret it as being part of a divine plan into which I must fit, so that I must first discover what the general blueprint is for the world and then ask what place I occupy in it. Not because there is an orchestra in which I have to play the flute and you have to play the violin, and if I try and play the violin, there'll be chaos. Not for that reason. It isn't a question of distribution of parts, or of trying to discover some general harmony and then asking myself, and what part do I play in it? It is because it is something which wells up inside me and tells me what to do. There is some kind of romantic, intuitive, semi-impulsive force within me which tells me what it is that I must do in order to realize myself most generously and most richly. This is really a form of unbridled personal, so to speak, self-assertion of a highly non-Christian and pagan kind. And this is where Fichte is to be found somewhere in the middle 90s. And that is why he says, to be free is nothing. To seek freedom is the very heaven. Frei sein ist nichts. Frei werden ist der Himmel. Because life is activity, it isn't passive. The worst of all things is passive contemplation. That's enslavement. That's sheer, so to speak, miserable enslavement. The important thing is to act. To search freedom is an activity. To be free is nothing at all. In fact, it doesn't exist. The life of man grown to proper estate is constantly to seek, to realize himself, to overcome obstacles, to perfect himself, to realize himself, realize all the potential which is locked up within him. As a result, a certain, so far so good, so to speak, or so far so bad. There is a certain perceptible shift, however, in Fichte's views at a certain point, which I will tell you about in a second. The only question is why it should have arisen. Well, there are many theories, of course, about the interplay of facts and ideas. We can't quite tell why anybody thought anything at the time when he did, with any certainty. We have no power of entering their minds at that moment, in spite of what some philosophers may think. But in the case of Fichte, I think in about 1801 or 1802, a shift in his doctrines begins, of a rather significant and, in the end, rather sinister kind. Partly, this is probably due to the failure of the French Revolution, which impressed even those who believed in it, failure in the sense that it led to the Jacobin terror and not to the liberation, or apparent liberation, of those who took part in it, who in fact, great many of whom, particularly the philosophers and the thinkers, found themselves hunted and persecuted, and some, of course, were beheaded or died in jail, like Condorcet. Partly, and therefore, instead of the French Revolution being acclaimed as the great liberating force in which each man was able to assert his full human nature, instead of being humiliated and degraded by some hideous, not even paternalist, feudal oppression of the rich or the priests or the politicians. Instead of that, mobs, the guillotine, Robespierre, terror, tyranny succeeded. And this, of course, sobered the heads of a great many Germans, who then decided that the French Revolution was either premature or altogether a mistake. Partly that. Partly, and therefore this directed people's thoughts in other directions. Perhaps individual self-assertion of the kind which they believed the French Revolution to stand for was not the right path. Perhaps something could be said for Burke's opposite point of view, whereby social association of a certain sort mustn't be broken too dramatically, by which people belong to each other in a somewhat different fashion from the rigid individualist libertarianism which was certainly preached by the early makers of the French Revolution. In part, this is also due probably to the attacks upon Germany made by the French Revolutionary armies, then succeeded by the attacks made upon her very successfully by Napoleon, which produced a great patriotic reaction, as we all know, a tremendous nationalist resistance to the foreign invader, which united the Germans as they had not been united before, and produced a great, huge sense of national solidarity against the common enemy. At any rate, somewhere in the early 19th century, Fichte begins saying, what actually is this self? What is this self which has to be liberated? What is this Schillerian hero, so to speak, who has to rise above circumstances, assert his will? Who is this man? What is he like? What is human nature, in fact? What is this nature which needs to assert itself? And he says, man becomes man only among other men. This sounds harmless enough. But he goes on. Man is destined to live in society. He must do so. He is not a complete human being and contradicts his nature if he lives in isolation. He hadn't always said that. There was a moment in which he thought that lonely thinkers were the only people worth thinking about, because these people rose above their environment, towered over them, and refused to accept the conventions of society and look with contempt and derision upon the mass of Philistines and bourgeois by whom he was surrounded. This, however, as I say, is altering slightly, most probably, historically speaking, because of the wave of common feeling which united him to his nation. The individual, he says, must endeavor to repay his debt to society. After all, the individual is made what he is by other men. He is not, man is not an island, and so on. He is born into a society, Herder again. He is born into a stream of already existing social memories, social images, social feelings. He is not born naked and doesn't receive impressions from some outside source, nor does he invent them for himself. He is born into a flux and into a stream of a national consciousness in which he is educated, which shapes him and which creates indissoluble links between him and other members of his society. Indeed, that's what being a man is. Being a man is, in some sense, having communication with others. Those who can't communicate can't speak. Those who can't speak can't think. Those who can't think aren't men in the ordinary sense of the word. Therefore, the individual must endeavor to live in society. Not only that, to repay his debt to society which has made him. He must take his place among men. He will strive to advance in some respect the perfection of the race which has done so much for him. That is now his new beruf. That is his function. That is his vocation. He must do something for the society. Not only for himself. He's part of a society. He mustn't think of himself as an isolated atom. True, once upon a time there were savage societies, as Fichte, in which everybody simply bowed beneath the yoke of material necessity. And people lived, as people do in savage societies, in terrible want and need, pressed together in a kind of half-conscious and savage state. But this oppressed man to such a degree that there was a revolt against it in the direction of individualism, of self-assertion. But this won't do. This atomizes society. This drives people away from each other and impoverishes them in some way. Very well. He must therefore render back to society what it has done for him. Because he is what he is because of it, and if he doesn't do that, he cheats it. No man on earth has the right to leave his powers unused and live on those of others. You must not be a parasite. This is a straight Herderian sentiment. You mustn't be a parasite and you mustn't be inactive. You must add your drop to this social treasure of society. This, so to speak, is an old populist cry, if you like, which derived directly from Herder, by whom Fichte was very evidently deeply influenced. But he doesn't stop there. He goes on to say in about 1803, nature is constituted by the organic union of all her forces. Humanity by the organic unity of all individual wills. This is a rather mysterious statement. In what literal sense can you say there is an organic unity of all individual wills? Well, he doesn't explain, but it's quite obvious that he thinks in some way that men cannot function without reciprocal activity, without in some way supplying each other's needs or living on some kind of relations with each other in society. This seems a platitudinous enough idea, but it strikes Fichte with great force. And he then says, how can men develop their innate capacities, their potential to its richest and fullest extent? They can't do it if they're too poor. They can't do it if they're too weak. Who will guarantee a standard of living? Who will give them protection that their most indispensable rights will not be trampled upon by stronger men? Why, he suddenly arrives at the surprising conclusion, the state must do that. How can the state do it? It can only do it if it really possesses the power to do it and is not itself subject to the buffetings of other states. And so you get born in Fichte a kind of proto-socialist idea that the state must become autarkic. A minimum guaranteed standard of living must be granted to all the citizens. Certain rights which the citizens agree about by means of an elaborate series of contracts must be established. How can it be the state be guaranteed to be able to perform its function? By being protected against the buffetings of other states, by being protected against the vagaries of the stock market, by being protected against any kind of blows, any kind of changes which might come upon it from outside. Therefore, it must become autarkic. It must protect itself against other states. It must cease to trade with other states. It must cease to have financial exchanges with other states. It must have its own money and never be allowed this money to be exported. It must be totally self-sufficient. Only if you have a totally self-sufficient state, and Fichte was a very extreme thinker, as you can see, only if you are self-sufficient can the state guarantee the standard of living and so on. Socialism in one country. This is the famous geschlossenes Handelsstaat of Fichte. This is the famous idea that only in a state which is protected against buffetings from outside can the citizens actually perform their full functions and rise to their full stature. Otherwise, the state might be too weak to protect them, or alternatively, the citizens may be ruined by unfortunate speculation abroad in foreign securities. Therefore, you get the notion in Fichte of a kind of socialism in one country, a completely self-protected, autarkic, protectionist state. And it is this that gives him a title to be considered as one of the fathers of collectivism or socialism, or anyhow, of the welfare state, of the organization of the lives of the citizens. We've traveled some distance, you will perceive, from the notion of the free citizen subject to nobody else's will, of the free citizens no longer interfered with by anyone, exfoliating himself like a plant in the sun without any other kind of influence being brought to bear upon him. This is simply in the course of trying to develop what are the actual conditions in which men can do this. And he then observes, the state cannot be artificially constructed out of any kind of material. The state is organic. The state is like a tree. At a certain point, he becomes frightened that perhaps if this is done, the individual will be sacrificed to the state, as used to happen. Perhaps the state will become tyrannical or despotic in the way in which, say, the French state under Louis XIV quite plainly was. Worse than that, in which the state under Frederick the Great in Prussia was. He may have made his citizens rich, and he may have developed their intellectual capacities, founded academies, done a great deal for them, but there was always the corporal stick. There was always a policeman at the back. The power of the king was absolute, and he was able to do what he liked with the citizens. And this surely must be avoided at all costs. Even though you may not speak of a king, but you may think of a state. And so he says, in no circumstances should the individual, considered strictly as an individual, be sacrificed to the whole. So far, so good. However unimportant the individual, however great the whole, or the interest of the whole that are at stake. This is impeccable liberal sentiment. But then he goes on. But part of the whole must often be placed in peril on account of the whole. The victims are selected not by the ruler, but by the peril itself, whatever that might mean. They are selected from among the individuals. That's to say, the ruler can sacrifice me, provided that he acts in the name of the peril. If there is a peril to the state, some people must be sacrificed to the whole. Not because the ruler wants it, but because the peril demands it. But then the question arises, who shall say that there is a peril, and who shall choose the victims? About that, Fichte is silent. Gradually you will find out that he thinks that a certain group of persons are charged with this particular duty. He then goes on to say, he harks back to his aesthetic ideal. Now, of course, he's in love with the state. Now he's considering, so to speak, how human beings should live in societies. And he says, the absolute state is in its form an artistic institution, intended to direct all individual power towards the life of the race. This is very some distance away from the original individualism. If the state is a work of art, then there must be an artist. Well, perhaps the artist is an unconscious artist. Perhaps he's heard as artist. Perhaps he's society itself, the people as a whole, acting in a kind of half-conscious capacity and creating the state even as they create epics or they create dances. There is perhaps no individual founder, no particular Lycurgus, no particular person who makes the state, but still the state is an artistic entity. And if it's an artistic entity, all the parts of it must subserve the general artistic plan. Now, if all the parts must subserve the artistic plan, then I, as an individual, become somewhat subjugated to the plan of the whole, and my liberty, which was originally spoken of by Fichte, becomes, to say the least, somewhat compromised. He goes on to say, every nation wants to extend its own peculiar good as far as it possibly can, so far as in it lies to incorporate the whole of mankind within itself, thereby following an urge planted in men by God. This is going rather further. If I know myself to be a good society, then so long as there are other societies outside me which I regard as less good, it becomes my duty before God to absorb these other societies. Because only by absorbing them can I see to it, can I guarantee, says Fichte, that they will not enslave me. If I am a good society and there are some less good societies by the side of me, I'm in some danger of being corrupted by them. The only way in which I can avoid the danger of being corrupted by them is by eating them, by swallowing them. By swallowing them, I make them impotent to injure me and indeed raise them to my own status. Apparently, I'm doing them good. But if you are a citizen of these other societies, this particular act of absorption might appear in a somewhat different light. This Fichte doesn't examine at all. Now, we've now arrived at a point at which he really abandons Kant, and to some extent abandons Schiller, and returns to some kind of Herderian ideal of unity. And he's the earliest German thinker who is not, in fact, what might be called a Catholic reactionary. The first Protestant progressive, as he certainly thought of himself, and was thought of by others, to praise the Middle Ages. To praise the Middle Ages because of the magnificent unity of the society of the Middle Ages, in which, so to speak, men acted as a great harmonious whole. They trusted each other, they loved each other, they believed in each other, and they acted as a loving society, thrusting themselves forward towards a single ideal instead of being a ghastly, atomized, competitive society of self-seeking egotists. This, however, is, as I say, points in a somewhat different, rather Burkean direction, and away from the original, so to speak, passionate, self-expressive ideal of the pure artist making his own life in whatever way he chooses. The big break occurs somewhere around 1803. I will now read you this particular quotation, and you will see that we have arrived at a rather critical point of Fichte's thought. He suddenly announces, the life of reason consists in this, that the individual forget himself in the species, that he must risk his life for the life of all and sacrifice his entire life to theirs. And then goes one step further. The individual doesn't exist. He must vanish. The group, the Gattung, alone exists. Only the group is real. This is the exact opposite of where we began. I mean, it's a complete reversal into of 180 degrees. What is the individual which is expressing itself? Originally, it was some kind of recognizable human being. Originally, it was a man of flesh and blood seeking to make his life. But this won't do. There always is, in Fichte's thought, the idea that behind the empirical man there is a transcendent self, something like the divine spirit which blows through the universe, something like God, something like a great universal principle towards which all individuals seek to unite themselves as the flame seeks to unite itself with the great central flame of the great sun which illuminates the world. This emerges from time to time, and you suddenly realize that the self he's talking about, or the true ego, is some kind of great metaphysical theological self, which is really not individual human beings at all, but something like the universe as a kind of animate entity of which we are merely aspects, of which we are merely fragments. But for the first time, he announces that the individual, the ego, that which has to express itself, that which has to be free, that which, so to speak, shapes the world in accordance with its will, is not the individual, but the group. And the individual is a mere fragment of the group. That's the beginning of the great myth, so to speak, of the superpersonal society, in which human beings are, if not cogs or wheels, at any rate elements of some kind. And this flatly contradicts his original view, where he says, for example, what about liberty? Liberty is the thing which, of course, is always on his lips and always on at the end of his pen. Liberty. What is liberty? Liberty is something which men must preserve. Liberty is activity. Liberty is spontaneity. Liberty is hearing the divine voice which tells me how to realize myself. Liberty is that which makes me free of the ghastly empirical world which is a mere treadmill and so forth. Happiness cannot be the human goal, because if happiness were the human goal, liberty would be a nuisance. It would be a nuisance because liberty allows me the possibility of choosing wrongly as well as choosing rightly. If happiness were the goal, would it not be far better if I was attached like a wheel to some well-oiled machine and therefore never had any alternatives at all? To be conditioned, to be brainwashed, to be attached to some huge organic entity as an element, not able to liberate myself from it, might actually make me satisfied and happy. But what it will take away from me, of course, is my individual liberty, my self-assertiveness, that which makes me a man, in short, my will. This is Kantian language. This now evaporates completely. Let me read you another passage written about 1804. To men as they are from birth, and as they are in their ordinary life, in their ordinary education, our philosophical theory is absolutely incomprehensible. For the object whereof it speaks doesn't exist for them. They do not possess the faculty by which one can apprehend this object. It is as if one were talking to men blind from birth, men who know things and their relations only by touch and do not understand what colors are or their relations. Now this means there are various kinds of men. There are men who are blind and there are men who can see. There are philosophers and there are non-philosophers. And it's really only the philosophers who truly understand what man is and what liberty is. The philosophers are the only people who truly hear the voice of the super-self, of this rather mystical element which drives us forward. And they alone understand what it is that it says. And anybody who dares to question it is subversive in principle. He says, to question the authority of the great imperative, which only the philosophers can hear, to question this authority is immoral in itself. It shows that you have no moral sense. To compel men to adopt the rightful form of government, to impose right upon them by force, is not only the right, but the sacred duty of every man who has both the insight and the power to do it. There may even be circumstances in which a single man has this right against the whole of mankind. For as against him and what he knows to be right, there is no man who has either rights or liberty. This man may compel them to write, that being an absolutely definite conception, valid for all men alike, a conception which they all ought to have, and which they all will have, as soon as they raise themselves to his level of intelligence, which in the meanwhile, thanks to the grace of God working within him, he alone holds in the name of all men as their representative. The truth of this conception he must take on his own conscience. He is, in fact, the compulsive power ordained of God, which is a reference to St. Paul. Now, we've traveled some way. The philosopher is now seen as Prospero, and the ordinary man is now seen as Caliban. The philosopher has the right to compel men to do that which, were they philosophers, they would compel themselves to do. This is old doctrine by which we say, you don't know what is good for you. I do. If you had my intelligence, you would do it freely. If you don't do it freely, it's because you don't understand. Either you understand what I understand, in which case I don't have to compel you, or you resist, which is evidence of the fact that you don't understand and I have to compel you. In other words, to make a man free in this sense means to give him that liberty which, were he different from what he is, he would want, And if he is not different what he is, so much the worse for him, and he was made different by me. Because I know what he really wants. I know his secret self, of which he is not aware himself, and it is in the name of this self that I compel his unfortunate empirical self to obey my orders. This is a program which almost every despot in history has in one form or another proclaimed. And it now emerges from the mouth of Fichte. The people has a metaphysical right to realize his destiny by every weapon of cunning or force, he says in an essay on Machiavelli. This is straight statism of the most compulsive, of the most tyrannical kind. He has the grace at this point to say that freedom is a two-edged weapon. That, in fact, it isn't nature but freedom which causes conflict. Savages freely choose to devour their enemies. Later nations, with the power of laws and unity and culture, do so too. Culture is not a deterrent to violence. Culture is a tool, can be a tool of violence. This is quite an interesting point, because in the 18th century the assumption was the more cultivated you were, the more peaceful you were. The more cultivated you were, the more harmonious you were. It wasn't possible to know and be cultivated and yet to be brutal and to be violent. Fichte sees that liberty cuts both ways. You are free to do good, you are free to do harm. Culture simply increases your weapons. Your weapons of destruction are more effective if you are civilized, less effective if you are savage. But liberty by itself doesn't stop you from inflicting harm. In fact, it may cause you to inflict more harm. Therefore, somehow this has to be prevented. Well, it must be prevented by making men less egoistic. When men shall no longer be divided by selfish purposes, and their powers no longer exhausted by struggles with one another, nothing will remain for them but to direct their united strength against the one common enemy who still remains unsubdued, resistant, uncultivated nature. This is a very worthy sentiment with which Hegel and Marx both spoke, particularly Marx. But Fichte says, we haven't arrived at this moment yet. What must we do in the meantime? In the meanwhile, we have to compel. In the meanwhile, we have to coerce. There are too many barbarians about, and too few philosophers. It is the philosophers who must set themselves up as a guild of rulers. And it's no good they're trying to infuse their knowledge into the masses, because the masses are brutish and they live by faith. And so you gradually get the emergence of a doctrine of doublethink. You gradually get the emergence of a doctrine by which there are higher persons and lower persons. The higher person must rule the lower persons, no doubt for their benefit, but not in such a way that the lower persons themselves can understand why this is done. You hope that by means of this kind of thing, you will gradually raise these people to a level of intelligence where they will themselves become liberated and free and equal to you, and it will not be necessary to coerce them. But meanwhile, centuries may pass. This is really a return to someone like Grimm, or even someone like Voltaire, who thinks that the only way to cultivate people is by coercing the unruly mob at the moment, in the hope that perhaps in 100 or 200 or 500 years' time, it will no longer be necessary to do it. This, so to speak, is a dictatorship of the wise, who have to use every kind of power in order to mold the mob, no doubt for its own benefit, but certainly against its wishes. Let me read you the famous passage which occurs in the speeches to the German nation, which he delivered in Berlin when Napoleon was there to a rather small audience, which took no notice of it. After the lectures were published, they became a tremendous success, and they have been read and reread in Germany from that day to this. He says, it is time to reveal to the light of day the essence of the German character. Here is the criteria of discrimination. Either you believe in an original principle in man, freedom, perfectibility, infinite progress of our species, or you believe in none of this. You may even have an intuition of the opposite. All those who have within them a creative quickening of life, or else assuming that such a gift has been withdrawn from them, at least await the moment when they are caught up in the torrent of original life, have some confused presentiment of this kind of freedom, and have towards it not hatred nor fear, but a feeling of love. These are part of primal humanity, and considered as a people, constitute what he calls the Urvolk, the primal people, in short, the people. And then he adds, I mean the German people. This is just added as a journal by Germans. Of course, he meant what Hegel meant. He meant all Germans, all Frenchmen, all Englishmen, all Scandinavians, everybody whom he respected in Northern Europe. All those, on the other hand, who have resigned themselves to represent only a derivative, second-hand product Men who think of themselves in this way, these will become such an effect and shall pay the price of their belief. They are only an annex to life. Not for them those pure springs which flowed before them and which still flow around them. They are but the echo coming from the rock, but a voice which is silent, of a voice which is silent. Considered as a people, they are excluded from the Urfolk. They are strangers, they are outsiders. The nation which has the name of German to this day is the nation which is creative and original. And then he goes on to say that the principle of exclusion is this. All those who believe in spiritual reality and in freedom of the life of the spirit, all those who believe in the eternal progress of the spirit through the instrumentality of freedom, whatever their native land or whatever the language they speak, they are of our race, they are part of our people, and they will join it late or soon. All those who believe in arrested being, in retrogression, in eternal cycles, or else those who put an inanimate nature at the helm of the world, like the French encyclopedists, whatever be their native country, whatever be their language, they are strangers to us. They are not Germans, and one should hope that they will be wholly cut off from our people. Now, this looks like a chauvinistic German passage, but it isn't that. To do Fichte justice, the criterion of being creative is being creative. He likes to think of the Germans as that, but he's prepared to accept into this particular group anybody who, as he says, is full of artistic feeling, full of creation, spontaneity, sense of these voices which speak to you from within some kind of sacred principle which animates you and so on. It becomes very mystical at this stage. And there are these others who are mere groveling Philistines who lead their lives in some kind of bourgeois fashion, who will never be able to hear this voice and who therefore have to be led by the others. And so you get a complete theory of two divisions of mankind. The rulers and the ruled, the superior and the inferior, the creative and the uncreative. And then the final cry is, also, Herr ein Zwingherr zur Deutschheit, hither a man who will compel us to Germanism. Whoever it might be, we hope that the king will perform this service, if not, then perhaps a senate. The prince is raised above the laws of individual ethics to a far higher level. Now, this is a complete circle. You cannot go start from one point and get to the other. If Fichte begins with a paean to individual liberty of a rather Schiller-like kind and ends with a tremendous, so to speak, hymn to the state, and above all, not only to the state, but to the sort of group of Platonic guardians who conduct the state, and subjugate everyone else to their wills. Because they alone know, they alone hear the secret voice, they alone are imaginative, they alone are creative, they alone are the artists. This is the way in which some romantics certainly saw Napoleon. Fichte didn't, because he was an enemy of Germany, and therefore he didn't like him. But there were those who rose above this particular nationalist feeling and saw in Napoleon some great artist who was molding mankind in new shapes, a great artist in politics. And these people really spoke in this kind of rather horrifying language. They said, either you are a creator or you are not. If you are a creator, then you can lift people to a very high level by your own marvelous inspired efforts. And if you are not creative, then the best thing which can happen to you is to be lifted by others. The fact that you may suffer agonies, you may even be killed in battles in the course of this lifting, is unfortunate. But surely you will never have attained such a height before. You ought to bless the hour in which these agonies and these tortures have lifted you to a height of intense experience to which never, never in your dreary bourgeois life could you have risen without it. This is the true romantic note, which afterwards is to be heard in all kinds of heroic statements from Treitschke onwards in Germany, to the Italian fascists, to the German Nazis, to a great many other persons of this kind. And this really derives its force from this division which is drawn by Fichte between the real man, who is imaginative, forceful, an artist, and the unreal man, who is mere human fodder, so to speak, who is mere material out of which the artist molds the society, which the artist as legislator. You will find it to its fullest degree, for example, in someone deeply influenced by Fichte like Carlyle. Carlyle is a strange figure who has no ancestors, no true ancestors in the English political tradition, and no progeny either, who derives directly from German Romanticism and again reinfects German Romanticism himself. Carlyle also believed in something of this kind. He believed that obedience was the greatest of the virtues, that the best thing which a nation could do is to submit itself to some violent man of genius who will lift it to some tremendous height away from the ludicrous, utilitarian, dreary ideals of mere everyday life with its small satisfactions, its small pains, and its small pleasures. This is really is the romantic and the violent romantic semi-fascist ideal for which Fichte is responsible. Now, it's perhaps time for me to end this lecture. Let me say two things. One is that there are three Fichtes, each of whom has his followers. There is Fichte number one, who praises the independent artist, the self-expression of the individual. And he is really the father of Byron, he is the father of all those artists in the 19th century who say that if you are called, if the call of art is the highest call, that in order to paint divine pictures, you can abandon your wife, you can destroy your children, you can do whatever you wish, because creativity gives certain rights, because the artist is a sacred vessel to whom everyone must yield, and he has special rights in society, not like those of other people. This is the notion of the, so to speak, artist as the creator, who has, so to speak, dominates his environment, not necessarily politically, but anyhow, who has special claims upon society and can do things which might otherwise be regarded as misdeeds or crimes, because he produces immortal works of genius which enrich mankind. That's the early Fichte, who has no political or social implications. This is Schiller's tragic hero. He may cause terrible damage, but he's a bigger figure than the others and therefore has larger claims upon mankind. The middle Fichte is the man who says we must organize society as best we can. We hope that one day they'll all be rational. They'll all be good. This is the Rechtsstaat Fichte. We must create a body of disinterested bureaucrats of a highly educated kind, exactly what was recommended by von Stein, by Hegel afterwards. A series of disinterested, highly educated managerial persons who will sacrifice themselves upon the altar of the public good, who will have no private interest to pull at them, who will, so to speak, in some way manage to conduct society in the direction of higher enlightenment and education, conducted in the direction in which society cannot conduct itself. Democracy always leads to, ultimately, to bloodshed, tyranny, mobs, and ignorance. The only way in which mankind can advance is under the tutelage of disinterested and devoted educators, for these purposes to be called soldiers, ministers, and other Platonic guardians. That's the second Fichte, and that is, roughly speaking, the Prussian state. That is the ideal of the Reichsstaat. That is the ideal of an oligarchical state in which we have no democracy, but the ideal of disinterested service on the part of special individuals, self-chosen to some extent, people who really know the inner light in Fichte's sense. And there is a third Fichte, which is a tremendous mystical romantic paean, so to speak, to some kind of violent ideal of the master race, or not necessarily race, master religion, master folk, master culture, masters of history, master class, anything you please, whom history has advanced into the front ranks and who in some way, because of this, have a right to dominate the others because they are nearer to God, because in some way they are an inspired group who have a right to assert themselves no matter what happens to those below them. And those below them must bless them because they alone are able to confer 1 hour of intense life upon them, which is surely worth a cycle of café. Those are the three Fichtes, and each, as you can see, had his followers in the 19th and the 20th centuries. This is the figure who, in a sense, of course, betrayed the rationalist and ultimately libertarian and ultimately even democratic ideals of Kant, and the harmless, benevolent, decent, populist ideals of Herder, who thought that there were many flowers in the garden and they needn't struggle each other at all. Let me finally remind you that the person who foresaw where this was going to lead was, of course, the poet Heinrich Heine, who in a very famous passage said, warning the French, I think, after 1830, not to down their weapons, not to disarm, because of the fearful danger from their neighbors, he said, Kantians will appear who will ruthlessly with sword and axe hack through the foundations of our European life. Armed Fichtians will come, whose fanatical wills neither fear nor interest can touch. And who shall say that he was altogether mistaken? Thank you very much.